Good day. Today is Monday, 20th October 2025. And before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button if having listened to the programme or whichever part of the programme you want to listen to and you like the programme and you want to indicate that fact. So with that, let's proceed and discuss the topics of today. And again, today's programme is going to be devoted almost entirely to Ukraine-related matters. And I am going to begin again, as I did in my previous programme, with a brief discussion about the military situation. To be precise, the military situation in one specific place, and that is Pokrovsk. Because the news that has been coming this morning, at least the reports that have been coming this morning, which, to stress, are not fully corroborated, but which may very well be true, speak of a complete collapse of Ukrainian resistance in Pokrovsk, or at least maybe not a complete collapse, but of a rapid collapse of Ukrainian resistance in Pokrovsk. The first thing to say is that this morning, the Russian Defense Ministry provided information, further information, about the capture of a railway position, a railway station in the Pokrovsk area. Now, this is not the main railway within Pokrovsk itself. There are reports that the Russians have captured that, but perhaps the Russian Defense Ministry would not go out of its way to report its capture. Rather, it is the capture of a place called Chunishino, which is located southeast of Pokrovsk, and which is apparently on, let's say, an elevation, a hill, and which is also a railway station, and it is located, as I said, to the southeast of Pokrovsk, more to the east maybe than to the south of Pokrovsk. And the interesting fact about the capture of this railway station, and I should say that railway stations and railways are natural fortresses, and usually the fights that have to take place in order to capture one of these places is prolonged, or at least has been so, over the course of this war. Anyway, the information that I've heard is that the Russians basically walked in. The Ukrainians had apparently already decided to retreat from this place, and that this rather strong position had simply been abandoned. Well, that's perhaps one place, that's one piece of information that the Russians have provided. This place, Chunishino, is located between Pokrovsk and Mirnograd, the large suburb to the east. So going back to what Radovka was saying a little while back, if the Russians do, or perhaps more correctly did, have a plan to advance northwards to the intersection, the point where Pokrovsk and Mirnograd merge with each other, which is somewhat to the north of these positions, well, the capture of Chunishino would make sense in that respect. But anyway, that was a detail. The reports, which, as I said, are not corroborated, speak of something much bigger taking place. They speak of a outright Ukrainian retreat from the whole of Pokrovsk, south of the railway. Well, I discussed this, I think, yesterday. But they also speak of the Russian army itself advancing north of the railway, even as the Ukrainians retreat across the railway northwards. The Russians are immediately following them. And in fact, what if these reports are true, is happening is starting to look less like an organized, orderly retreat and more like a rout with the Russians in full pursuit. And to be clear, if this is all true, then again, there's no formal official confirmation of this from the Russian Defense Ministry, and there's no video footage, but the reports that are making these claims come both from Russian and some Ukrainian sources, then as we are looking at probably the imminent fall of Pokrovsk itself. I cannot imagine if the central area of Pokrovsk, the major conurbation that is Pokrovsk, the central part of the conurbation that is Pokrovsk, the original town of Pokrovsk, if you will, if resistance there is collapsing, I cannot imagine that resistance can continue in Mirnograd either. I would assume that the Ukrainians are going to try to retreat from Mirnograd as well over the next couple of days. Always, it seems, in this very chaotic manner. And of course, it would not just be Pokrovsk in that case that would be on the brink of collapse. Rodinska, a little to the north, where intense fighting continues to take place. The Russians claim to have surrounded the Ukrainian forces that were defending Rodinska, a small town just to the north of Pokrovsk. Anyway, Rodinska presumably would then fall very, very quickly. And then, of course, the Russians would be very well positioned to advance further north, both to the west, to the town of Dobropilia, and to the town of Druzhivka, which is located between Kramatorsk and Konstantinovka, effectively surrounding the latter. But anyway, maybe we shouldn't move too far ahead, because to repeat again, these reports are very sketchy and unclear. They are, however, trickling in, and they do suggest, as I said, that there is, well, not just an operational crisis for the Ukrainians in Pokrovsk, but something altogether much, much worse. It seems, if these reports are true, to repeat again, if these reports are true, that the Ukrainian garrisons in Pokrovsk and Mirnograd, perhaps understanding that they are in the process of being encircled and that all escape routes are being closed, and understanding also that the Ukrainian counterattacks in the area to the northeast of Pokrovsk, in the area of the Russian breakthrough of August, have been unsuccessful, despite claims to the contrary by General Sirsky and by the Ukrainian staff, general staff. It looks as if the Ukrainian garrison in Pokrovsk has basically lost hope, realized that the defense of Pokrovsk is becoming impossible, and is doing what the Ukrainians have done in other places, in Lysychansk, for example, in Avdeyevka, to some extent in Ugledar, that they are undertaking a hurried and disorganized retreat from an undefendable position through territory that is effectively already controlled by the Russians, guaranteeing that losses for the retreating troops are going to be extremely high. Now, again, to repeat, this is all, it's not quite rumour, but it is reporting that is not yet fully corroborated. It may be that the situation in Pokrovsk is more stable and that the Ukrainians are still holding positions in Pokrovsk and in Mirnograd. But if these reports are true, it would absolutely not surprise me. And if they're not true now, I think something fairly similar is likely to happen at some point anyway within the next couple of days or weeks. Of course, if the reports are true, then there is a strong likelihood that Pokrovsk will have passed entirely under Russian control before Trump and Putin meet in Budapest in perhaps 2 or maybe 3 weeks' time. So anyway, a very chaotic and confusing situation in Pokrovsk, but one which points to a disaster, a possible disaster experienced by the Ukrainians. And to repeat again, if Ukraine loses Pokrovsk, it is a disaster for Ukraine, in my opinion, even greater than the loss of Kursk region, the Suja and the territory Ukraine captured in Kursk region in March will have been. Anyway, lots of other things are going on in other places. There are now reports from Ukrainian channels which also speak of Russian soldiers having established a presence in southern Kherson city on the west bank of the Dnieper River. Again, details are very sketchy, but the Ukrainians themselves now appear to be admitting that this is indeed happening. How many Russian troops are involved, whether these are just raiding parties or scouting parties that are crossing the river, finding Ukrainian positions abandoned and are simply occupying ground rather than proper regular forces crossing the river with the intention of capturing ground and consolidating. All of that is very, very difficult to say. Whether the Ukrainians are in any position to push back in Kherson City, also, again, very difficult to say. But this is important news also. And as I said, it is, to some extent at least now, being corroborated by the Ukrainians themselves. And of course, if the Russians capture, or recapture rather, Kherson City, or even significant parts of it over the next couple of days or weeks, then obviously this is going to be a massive defeat psychologically for Zelensky and for the Ukrainians. It'll mean the reversal of what was perhaps their most spectacular victory in autumn of 2022. And it will be taken, I think, by many people in Ukraine, as, and by the way, in the West also, as a clear-cut sign that Ukraine is indeed losing the war. And there are also reports, still reports, that the Russians are either inside the town of Liman itself or very close to it. And there are reports that the Russians are fighting in Siversk. And as I've discussed in many programs now, it looks as if the Russians control the entire residential area of Kupiansk on the west bank of the Oskol River, and that the Ukrainian forces on the east bank, the industrial part of Kupiansk, are cut off and are unable to receive supplies, and that the situation for the Ukrainian troops there is deteriorating also by the hour, and that their resistance too is becoming more and more disorganized. But it is perhaps Pokrovsk, which is the most important battle. And anyway, we can see how it is currently playing out. Now, all of this obviously has great bearing on the diplomacy. And it may be what is to some extent behind the story that has appeared in the Financial Times, but has which has been circulating in all sorts of other media outlets as well, though I suspect that all of it ultimately derives from an article which has appeared in the Financial Times. Anyway, this article, which is entirely drawn on information provided by European officials to the Financial Times, some of them, I have no doubt at all, British. Anyway, they have provided a description of the meeting between Trump and Zelensky in the White House on Friday. And what they describe is a full-blown row. Trump supposedly shouting, raised voices, swearing, at least on Trump's part, and Trump being shown maps, or at least Zelensky trying to show maps to Trump, trying to persuade Trump that actually the situation on the front lines isn't that bad, that Ukraine is holding its positions, that it is in fact winning the war, that all claims and reports that the Russians are breaking through in Donbass are untrue. Anyway, it seems that Trump, at least according to the Financial Times, became increasingly impatient, said that he's been shown these maps time and time again, and that he's getting fed up seeing them, and apparently he threw them aside in, well, clearly something of a rage. Now, it is very important to stress that this is an article in the Financial Times, and of course the journalists who are writing this article were not present in this meeting in the White House, and nor, presumably, were the European officials who say they have been briefed about the meeting and who are in turn briefing and providing this story to the Financial Times. So we have it entirely at second hand, and nobody who was directly involved in the meeting, it seems, described the meeting to the Financial Times and was behind this article. And the Financial Times itself, I am very sorry to say, is not a fully reliable reporter. It is, after all, only a few days ago published another article, this time about another Trump meeting, on this occasion the Trump meeting with Putin in Anchorage in Alaska back in August. And the account of that meeting was that Putin lectured Trump for ages about the history, was talking about Bogdan Khmelnytsky and Mazepa perhaps, and all sorts of other things, the long history of Russia and Ukraine, and that Trump became increasingly angry and frustrated at this lecture that Putin was giving him, and that Trump at one point was almost on the brink of walking out of the meeting, and anyway cut short the meeting, which as a result lasted only 1.5 hours, and that Trump supposedly then cut short the entire summit. The summit was supposed to last for 2 days, and which is true, by the way, and that the meeting between Trump and Putin was a debacle, and that, in fact, it caused Trump to shift and to decide that perhaps it was Zelensky who was providing Trump with the better information. After all, it turned Putin against Trump. Trump against Putin, and Trump made Trump more favourable to Zelensky. Now, this article, which appeared in the Financial Times about the Alaska summit, I am sure is fundamentally and profoundly wrong. Or it may be that some incidents like that did take place in Alaska. But bear in mind, the article has appeared in October about a summit meeting between Putin and Trump, which took place in August. If things had really been that bad, I think it is inconceivable that we would only be finding out about it in October instead of closer to when it happened, which is in August, which was in August. But as I have already pointed out in previous programs, it is in fact most unlikely that this account anyway is true. The meeting between Putin and Trump in Alaska seemed to end in good terms. There was a press conference. Putin spoke about an understanding or apparent understanding that had been reached between himself and Trump. Trump said less, but all seemed to be perfectly cheerful and happy at the news conference. And of course, the news conference ended with Putin inviting Trump to come to Moscow and doing so in English, and Trump not giving any sign that he disagreed. So all of the atmospherics surrounding the Trump-Putin summit in Alaska suggested an at least polite or even friendly affair, very different from the impression given by the Financial Times article, which appeared a few days ago. So if the Financial Times is giving a basically wrong account of the Alaska summit, how can we be sure that it is not also giving a wrong account, a false account of the meeting between Zelensky and Trump in the White House on Friday? Well, there are some reasons to think that part of the account the Financial Times is giving of the Trump-Zelensky meeting is true. The most important is that so far, neither government, neither the Ukrainian government, nor the American government have come out straightforwardly and said that the Financial Times account of the Trump-Zelensky meeting was flat out untrue. Now, here I'm going to also express my own personal biases, if you like. On the eve of the Trump-Zelensky meeting on Friday, I did a program. And I said that Zelensky was likely to be extremely angry when he came to this meeting. He was expecting to meet Trump, to get Trump's agreement to supply Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine. He was looking for strong words of support from Trump, and the deteriorating military situation on the front lines would have made Zelensky even more anxious for that. And instead, what he will have learnt is that Trump, the night before, the day before, had had a telephone conversation with Vladimir Putin, the man who Zelensky subsequently said he personally loathes, and that it was most unlikely that Trump would agree to provide him with the Tomahawk missiles. And I said in my program that an angry Zelensky is a temperamental and difficult to control Zelensky, and though it was likely that members of his delegation and the European leaders would have been trying to get Zelensky to keep his temper, there was a real possibility that the meeting with Trump would blow up just as the meeting with Trump blew up the one which took place in February earlier this year. Well, given that that is so, you will understand why I am not surprised that the meeting between Zelensky and Trump on Friday might very well have turned acrimonious, with raised voices and swearing taking place, much as the Financial Times says. Now, having said that, even if there was a row, and I think there was, it doesn't follow that the rest of all the Financial Times article is true. In the case of the Oval Office row in February, the media spun a story that the row was provoked by Trump and the Vice President, J.D. Vance, and make it appear that Trump and Vance ambushed Zelensky, and that Zelensky was merely reactive throughout the row. In fact, if you watch the entire film of the row, it's absolutely clear that it was Zelensky who came to the meeting in a terrible mood, who was spoiling for a fight, and who went out of his way to provoke it. And I strongly suspect that if there was a row at the meeting on Friday, as I believe, then it was Zelensky again who almost certainly started it. He would not have been happy when Trump told him he was not going to get the Tomahawk missiles. And if the reports of the Financial Times and the rest of the media are true, then he would not have been happy either with all of the various things that Trump, the other things that Trump told him as well. Because the Financial Times and the American and British media are saying that Trump told Zelensky that he is losing the war, that he's not only not going to get the Tomahawks, but he's never going to get enough weapons to turn the situation round, that the Russians have not conducted an outright war, but only a special military operation, that what Zelensky needs to do is to give up Donbass at the very least, and that if he's not prepared to do that, and presumably to accept other parts of the Istanbul Plus package, the demands that Putin set out when he spoke to the Russian Foreign Ministry on the 14th of June 2024, then Ukraine stood a high probability of being destroyed. And of course, Zelensky would not have been happy to hear any of those things and would not have been willing to accept any of those things. He insists publicly that he is winning. He insists publicly that the Russians are losing. He continues to trot out endlessly claims about the Russians suffering unimaginably huge casualties. I believe that at one point, some people are saying that he spoke about the Russians having lost up to 3 million men. At least this is what I've heard. And he obviously isn't accepting the accounts, the facts about the Russians winning the war. And he is completely, as he has made clear time and again, he is completely opposed to retreats from any part of the front lines. And he is absolutely not going to give up Donbass. He's not going to give up Slovyansk, Kramatorsk, Konstantinovka, the front line, the defense line of fortified cities that the Financial Times itself, by the way, acknowledged is Ukraine's major fortified position. The article in the Financial Times even went so far, by the way, as to suggest that if Ukraine were to lose this line of fortified cities, the Russians would be able to advance rapidly all the way to Kiev itself. Just saying. Anyway, that was what the Financial Times said. Zelensky was absolutely not going to accept that. And, well, the meeting spiraled downwards, apparently, from that point going forward. Zelensky, furious not to get the tomahawks he thought he was going to be given, and doubly furious to be told instead to come to terms with the Russians, basically on the basis of the conditions that the Russians, the Vladimir Putin, has set out. And you can see all of this appearing in the Financial Times, in other articles, especially in the British media, which, of course, is hostile to Trump and even more hostile to Putin, and which is extraordinarily, continues to be extraordinarily supportive of Zelensky. You hear comments about how Trump was repeating Putin talking points, never any willingness to acknowledge that, yes, I mean, it may be Putin who's saying these things, and they might indeed be talking points, but that doesn't tell us whether or not they are true. In this case, about the military situation, almost certainly, in fact, undoubtedly, they are true. And Zelensky probably also didn't like being told by Trump that the Russian economy is not on the brink of collapse, that it's holding up well to the sanctions. Trump, of course, himself has on many occasions also suggested that the Russian economy is on the brink, on the point of collapse. You know, he's written about it. He's been doing it recently, over the last couple of days, weeks, in fact. And, well, Zelensky probably brought all that up again, tried to pressure Trump again into imposing massive sanctions against the Russians. And, well, we saw Trump pushing back and saying to Zelensky, no, sanctions aren't going to work. The Russian economy is not collapsing. It's doing perfectly well. Thank you very much. So, clearly, all of these accounts suggest a difficult meeting. And the accounts also say that Witkoff, who was also apparently participating in the meeting, also tried to get Zelensky to understand that the war must be ended and that it can only be ended if Ukraine is to survive, basically by accepting Russian terms. So I could completely see, if these were indeed the things that Trump and Witkoff and perhaps others were trying to get Zelensky to accept over the course of this meeting, that the meeting spiraled out of control and went badly. Well, the meeting itself is interesting. The fact that the relationship between Zelensky and Trump is again clearly bad is also interesting. But where actually does it leave us? The first thing to say is that it is most unlikely that Trump has suddenly come round to all of these opinions, all of these views about the true state of the war and about the true state of the Russian economy, simply because the day before he had a 2.5 hour conversation with Vladimir Putin. Putin will no doubt have explained all of these things to Trump, but the fact that Trump was making these points to Zelensky in the way that he was suggests to me that Trump has never really bought into the narrative that Ukraine is winning the war. I said that at the time when Trump published his Truth Social post about 2 weeks ago, in which he said that Ukraine is winning the war, the whole Truth Social post frankly had an ironic or even sarcastic quality about it. And the same point was made much better than by me, by Larry Johnson on Sonar 21. So I don't believe that Trump has ever really bought into this story that Ukraine is winning the war. What Trump has believed about the economic situation in Russia, I'm not going to dwell on because I simply don't know. But on the military situation, I can't help but think that these accounts of the Zelensky-Trump meeting strongly suggest that Trump knows that Zelensky has been lying to him and has been lying to him all along about the military situation, and that those senior American officials who have been telling Trump the same thing, perhaps without knowing, have simply been repeating Zelensky's lies. And if it is true that Trump pushed Zelensky's maps away, you can see the anger which has probably been festering there for some time. Now, that in turn begs a number of questions, because if Trump has always known that Ukraine is losing the war, if he's always known that Zelensky is lying to him, why does he give Zelensky the time of day? Why does he continue to have regular conversations with Zelensky? Why does he meet with Zelensky? Why has he had Zelensky visit the White House no fewer than 3 times? Why does he just go along with this pretense, this narrative that Zelensky has been spinning? Well, I am not going to try to read Trump's mind here. I mean, I don't know Trump at all. Never had any dealings with him, obviously. And it's extremely difficult to work out a personality from a distance. It could be, that Trump has up to now bought in to the well-established neocon plan, the Aaron Wes Mitchell plan outlined in that article in National Review that was published in August 2021, that the United States needs to keep up the war against Russia and defeat Russia in Ukraine in order to weaken Russia and to draw Russia away from its alliance with China. It may be that Trump has always supported that plan and is signed up to that plan. He obviously wants to focus on China, and he understands that Russia is allied with China, so he wants to use the war to weaken China's main principal ally. And it could be that the reason he's now turning on Zelensky in the way that he's just done is because he realizes that, in fact, it is not Russia that is being weakened by the war. It is the United States that is being weakened by the war. And Trump has recently given a whole series of comments, public comments to the media. These comments have been caught on camera. Trump made them knowing that he was speaking to camera. That the United States has depleted its arsenals, that it's short of all sorts of weapons, that it doesn't have a super abundance of Tomahawk missiles either, that it is more important that the United States holds on to its weapons rather than deprives itself of them. And that means that a president who has to take into account the national interests of the United States cannot continue to supply weapons in this profligate manner that has been done previously to Ukraine. And that it's the realization that the war, far from weakening Russia, is weakening the United States, that it is this that the president, that Donald Trump, has understood now, and which has caused him to change his stance and to change his mind and to say enough's enough. We've done all that we can. We can't be asked to do more. This strategy isn't working. We've got to come up with something else. So that may be what this is all about. I personally prefer to believe, I say it straightforwardly, want to believe that Trump does and has always wanted to find some means to sort out a relationship with Russia. I think he does harbour plans to separate Russia from China, and believes that opening up Russia to American business is the good way to do that. Probably he also sees Russia as some enormously attractive business opportunity for the United States and for people close to him. And perhaps Trump, who does seem to want to avoid wars with adversaries who are able to keep the war going for a very, very long time, also doesn't want to get himself involved in some lengthy, difficult, potentially very dangerous conflict with the Russians. And yes, he is always looking for leverage over the Russians. He talked about Tomahawk missiles at various times, and sanctions on Russia, and tariffs against Russia's trading partners, because he wants to find means to gain leverage over the Russians, and understands that up to now he's had very little, but that he's understood that that leverage isn't there. And for that reason, he's decided that he's going to finally acknowledge the reality of the conflict in Ukraine, and perhaps that explains his stance. There is a third view, very unflattering to Trump, which, by the way, I think also, unfortunately, is partly true, which is that Trump is extremely nervous of taking on the neocons in Washington. Lindsey Graham, Keith Kellogg, all of those people. And he is extremely nervous of publicly falling out with the Europeans. And he is also nervous of being blamed for any American defeat or perceived American defeat in the war. But ultimately, as I said, you can try and guess Trump's motivations and devote a huge amount of time to this. But ultimately, if he sticks by this policy of not giving more weapons to Ukraine, well, it won't really matter what his motivations are. If he's finally decided, if the meeting on Friday really is the point of no return, then, as I said, whether he's a neocon who's given up on a neocon plan, or somebody who does have some genuine desire to achieve some kind of détente with Russia, or whether he's just running scared of the neocons, but now understands that the situation is so bad on the battlefronts that there's really no point any longer in pretending and that the time has come up to stand up to them. Well, it really doesn't matter. But will Trump stick to this position? Will he continue to take the line that the media is telling us that he's taking for the moment? Will he indeed refuse to continue to refuse to supply Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine? Will he indeed gradually distance himself from Zelensky and Ukraine, as he's at various times intimated that he might do? Will he indeed use Budapest in order to try to draw a line under the whole Ukraine debacle and move forward with some kind of constructive dialogue, perhaps on strategic arms issues and other matters with the Russians as well? Well, I'm going to suggest that there might be reasons why he might do that. I understand that there is every reason for skepticism, and I share that skepticism. But bear in mind a number of things. The Tomahawks probably represent the extreme limit of the weapons that the United States can provide to Ukraine. Trump has now been advised, and there doesn't seem to be any doubt about this, that the Tomahawks, if supplied to Ukraine, would not change the military situation on the battlefronts. Ukraine would still lose and would dangerously and further deplete American arsenals. And he clearly doesn't want that. And it is the case in general that American inventories, American supplies of weapons are now dangerously run down. And there is a compelling argument, therefore, that the time to stop this constant supply of weapons to Ukraine must now be brought to an end, that it has gone as far as it can, and that for the wider strategic interests of the United States in the Pacific, in the Middle East, in Latin America, in Africa, this open wound needs to be closed. So that argument undoubtedly is there. And Trump himself, as I said, in cameras, to the two cameras, is repeating it, which shows that it has, at least to some extent, hit home with him. So that's one reason why he might be saying to himself that this is the moment to turn the page, to move beyond this whole Ukraine, Project Ukraine saga. Bear in mind, this is the first time that Trump himself has spoken in this way. Other US officials have done so, but up to now, Trump has avoided talking about the rundown of American military inventories. When the Pentagon tried to stop deliveries of certain weapons to Ukraine, I believe it was in June, including Patriot missiles, interceptors, Trump pretended that he didn't know about this decision in advance and went through the pretense of seeking to reverse it. He made statements and comments that, yes, indeed, Ukraine would get its weapons, the Patriot missile interceptors especially, and that this would all be sorted out within the next couple of weeks. Trump is not saying that now. He himself now is acknowledging the rundown in America's inventories. And as I've discussed in many programs, even Donald Trump, even the President of the United States, cannot simply magic up weapons which don't exist. He has no magic wand which will create Tomahawk missiles or Patriot missiles. He can only supply that which is already there. So that is one reason why, given that we've now reached that point, Trump, perhaps this time, is being more serious about putting this all behind him, putting Ukraine, in a sense, behind him, and why he's been prepared to push back against Zelensky to an extent and to a detail that we have never seen before since his presidency. When they previously rowed in the Oval Office in February, the discussion was short and it was all about generalities. This time it lasted for 2.5 hours. There appears to have been a discussion about the military situation and about weapons supplies and sanctions, and Trump, for once, actually addressed these specific issues and went into the details. The second is that if this was an elaborate attempt to try to get leverage over the Russians, then he clearly failed. The Russians have not buckled to any of the threats over sanctions, and they've not buckled to any of the threats over the Tomahawk missiles. Again, I noticed that Trump was actually asked over the course of an interview, one of his meetings with a US journalist, and again, this was all on camera, whether the Russians, whether Putin had been pushed to the negotiating table, had agreed to the meeting in Budapest because the United States had been on the brink of supplying Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine. And Trump, I noticed, said, well, he didn't think so. He cast doubt on that whole explanation. I think, on the contrary, what I think probably would have unnerved Trump much more is the warnings from Putin that if the missiles were indeed delivered to Ukraine, the entire dialogue with Russia, the whole prospect of ending the war, would be ended. So on this, I suspect it's Trump who's given ground more than Putin has. So anyway, so this was another factor, probably. Trump understanding, finally, that sanctions, threats of more weapons, intelligence assistance to Ukrainian drone operators to carry out drone strikes deep inside Russia, all of that, that wasn't making the Russians to change their stance. What it was doing instead was bringing the entire relationship between Russia and the United States to a point of breakdown. But the third reason, ultimately, must be the most important one, which is that with all of the other things, the supplies of the weapons, the supplies of the intelligence assistance, the attempts to get leverage, the real leverage is not being acquired by the United States. It is being acquired by Russia. It is the Russians who, after all, are winning in Ukraine. Now, I don't know how much of the detail of the war Trump has, but perhaps, just possibly, alongside the information from Kellogg and Waltz and people like that, and Zelensky himself, he's also getting other information from other sources, perhaps from Orban, that in fact the reality is quite otherwise. And it is the Russians who are about to win, that it is the Russians who are going to break through and are about to capture Pokrovsk and Kupiansk and all of these places, and that the state of the Ukrainian military is in reality, well, critical. And of course, if Trump wants to avoid anything, it is association with a major military defeat. He will not want to be seen as the person who was continuing to back Ukraine, who was continuing to throw money and weapons at Ukraine at precisely the moment when Ukraine started to go down. And perhaps the fear of that outweighs for Trump the fear of being blamed if he pursues a relationship with Putin and Ukraine nonetheless goes on fighting by itself and does as a result go down. So again, I can see why, from Trump's perspective, the meeting on Friday might have been the end point. He's tried to ride both horses at once for the whole of this year. He's tried to keep on good terms with the Europeans, the neocons, and with Zelensky, even as he's tried to build a relationship with Putin and with Russia. He's thought that he can somehow square the circle and can do both things at once. On Friday, just possibly, he might have understood that this was impossible, that he has to make a choice, and being Donald Trump, he's made the choice to go with the winner and not with the loser. Anyway, that's the meeting on Friday. Now, there again continues to be enormous speculation about the contents of the discussion between Putin and Trump and what Putin may have suggested to Trump over the course of both the conversation and what happened at the summit in Alaska and what Putin discussed with Witkoff in August. And a recent article in the Washington Post has again said that Putin has told Trump that in order for there to be peace in Ukraine, a negotiated peace in Ukraine, the Ukrainians must withdraw from Donbass, must entirely withdraw from Donbass. If they withdraw from Donbass, there might not just be a ceasefire on the existing front lines in Zaporozhye and Kherson, but the Russians might even be prepared to pull back in some places. Now, I am not party, let me stress again, to any of these discussions. I have already said in previous programs, stretching all the way back to August, that if Putin has at some point accepted or entertained the idea that the Russians might agree a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, provided the Ukrainians agreed to withdraw from Donbass, it would not astound me. It would not shock me. From a Russian point of view, at least specifically from Putin's point of view, as I discussed at length in my program yesterday, this is a conflict which began in Donbass, Zaporozhye and Kherson regions arguably matter less. The Russians no doubt will insist on their land bridge to Crimea. I can't imagine that they would ever negotiate that away. But if the city of Zaporozhye and Kherson region west of the Dnieper remain under Ukrainian control, well, It may be that if Putin thinks that he can achieve all his other objectives in Ukraine out of NATO, the security system in Europe renegotiated, protections for Russians and Russian speakers in Ukraine, well, it might be that he might be tempted to do it. And I noticed yesterday that when Peskov, Putin's spokesman, was asked about the speculations that are there in the American media that Putin and Trump again discussed land swaps, Peskov refused to be drawn. He said that the Russians have already provided a complete briefing, Ushakov's briefing, about what Putin and Trump said to each other over their recent call, and he's not prepared to go beyond that. I don't think one should read too much into that comment, by the way. But anyway, that was what Peskov said. Anyway, the point is, and this is where we come back to this article in the Financial Times, to all of the very things that Zelensky has said over the course of the last couple of days since the meeting in Washington between himself and the meeting in the White House between himself and Trump. Zelensky continues to refuse any retreat from any position. He continues to insist that all the ground, all the territory that Ukraine holds, it must still have. He even is saying that Trump agreed with him in the end about this, which I suspect goes far beyond anything that Trump actually and truly said. So Zelensky is not prepared to pull back from Donbass. And the Europeans, over the last couple of hours, have made it clear again that they fully support Zelensky in this. Donald Tusk, the Prime Minister of Poland, says that, as far as he is concerned, the most important territorial compromise would amount to appeasement, always this horrible word that gets resurrected whenever negotiations to find a way to end the conflict in Ukraine start. The German foreign minister has spoken about how the only acceptable situation where the Russians, where Putin comes to the territory of the European Union, would be where the Russians basically agreed to stop their aggression and end the war on, in effect, Ukrainian terms. And, well, one only has to look at the various statements and comments that have been appearing on X from various European officials. And they continue to support Zelensky in what I have to say I would straightforwardly call his intransigence. I think one can use this word validly because Zelensky refuses to make concessions in the face of an overwhelmingly negative situation on the battlefronts. And I'm going to say it. I think he's going to continue to do this. I said this in my program yesterday, and I'm going to repeat it again. He's going to continue to do this, even if the Russians recapture Donbass, even if they battle through to the Dnieper, even if they capture Zaporozhye and Kherson region, even if the Russians reach the gates of Kiev itself. Zelensky is the product of a political system in Kiev, which ever since the Maidan coup of 2014 has been organized and structured around extreme hostility to Russia, one could use much stronger words to describe it, passionate hostility, hatred of Russia. Moreover, despite the ongoing disasters that we are seeing on the battlefronts, despite the collapse of the Ukrainian economy, despite the massive exodus of people from Ukraine, it's important to say that over the course of this war, this political structure in Kiev has been getting more and more powerful. We see that the government itself has become increasingly radicalized. We see that it has become increasingly reliant upon the hardline militias, the hardline nationalist militias, which in turn have become increasingly organized. We see that all voices that might have pointed towards compromise and negotiations have been sidelined. I spoke yesterday about the moves to sack the mayor of Odessa, who, by the way, is still claiming that he remains the mayor of Odessa, even though in practice he's clearly been ousted and can no longer function in that role. But there's preparations being done to do the same thing to the mayor of Kiev itself, Klitschko, and I believe the mayor of Chernigov also now is facing pressure to step down as well. And there's even reports that there are attempts being made again to force Kirilo Budanov, the head of Ukrainian military intelligence, to step down. Budanov, until the summer of last year, was clearly a hardliner. As the war has gone increasingly against Ukraine, one can see that he has started to develop doubts. Earlier this year, he spoke about how, if Ukraine had not achieved peace by midsummer, the situation would start to turn catastrophic. By the way, that is exactly how it is turning out. And, well, you are starting to see clear signs again that in Kiev, Budanov's position is weakening, and that Zelensky and Yermak and Sirsky and all of those are trying to find ways to remove him. It's been suggested, I read, I think it was a Finnish commentator, suggested, a Finnish MP who is also a commentator, suggested that one of the things that Putin and Trump need to talk about when they meet in Budapest is removing Zelensky from the presidency in Ukraine. I think that might have been possible last year after the fall of Avdiivka, but the window has closed, and I don't think this time it can be done, especially since Zelensky continues to have the Europeans behind him. So I don't think that Zelensky is going to be pushed out. And even if he is pushed out, I cannot imagine that anybody who will take his place will feel about the Russians differently from the way that Zelensky himself does, or will be prepared to negotiate. So everything suggests to me that whatever Putin and Trump agree with each other in Budapest, the war will continue, and the Russians, whatever Putin's diplomatic wishes might be, the Russians will have to keep advancing. They'll have presumably at some point advance towards Odessa itself. They'll cross the river. Of course, if the reports that they're in Kherson City are true, and they probably are, then they have already crossed the river. And they're already, again, edging closer to Odessa. Anyway, the point is that one way or the other, the war will go on, and the Russians will have to win, and they will have to impose a military solution. So, in some respects, the diplomacy between Putin and Trump is irrelevant to the outcome of the war, because the war is already lost. But in spite of that, Zelensky won't compromise, and nor will his supporters in Europe. It's, in some respects, very like what happened with the Confederacy in the American Civil War. There was no surrender, negotiation, serious negotiation between the Confederacy and the United States, even at the so-called Hampton Roads Conference in March 1865. They were still trying to find ways to maintain their independence of the United States. The president of the Confederacy, Jefferson Davis, never gave up the struggle. There was a military collapse, but never a negotiated outcome. And I suspect the same is going to happen with the Ukrainians. The kind of terms that the Ukrainians might accept are by definition completely unrealistic and unacceptable to the Russians. And the kind of terms that the Russians are proposing are never going to be acceptable to the Ukrainians. Arrangements that would safeguard the rights of Russian speakers in Ukraine, which might give the Russians the right to their language and to give that language some kind of official status, that in itself is going to be unacceptable to the Ukrainians. And it is also going to be unacceptable for the Ukrainians to allow the Russian Orthodox Church to re-establish itself and to regain possession of its property. So, given the size of the Gulf, I can't myself see how there can be peace. If the Europeans were prepared to change their stance, if they were to tell Zelensky and the Ukrainians that it's game over, well, that might change the calculus. But again, there is no evidence in Europe that the European leadership is prepared to do that. The articles that have appeared in the European media about the meeting between Zelensky and Trump on Friday shows that what they are instead working towards doing is blaming the ultimate defeat in Ukraine on Donald Trump. So anyway, there we are. That's, I think, the situation. In my opinion, the only function, the only real purpose of the meeting in Budapest, assuming it takes place, is for the Americans and the Russians. Well, perhaps they can agree on a way forward with Ukraine, but if so, they should understand that whatever they agree with each other is not going to be acceptable in Kiev or in Europe. What the Americans and the Russians need to do is to use this summit meeting in Budapest in order to sort out the intractable problems in their own relations. First and foremost, they need to get negotiations to extend the START Treaty, which is due to expire in February. They need to get those negotiations started, and they need to extend the START Treaty itself for at least another year. And yes, let's get the air links between the United States and Russia reinstated again. Let's sort out the problems with the embassies. We can start doing these things. They can start doing these things. And perhaps in time, they can build on them and they can achieve more. In and of themselves, these would be important measures that would take much of the tension and instability out of the current situation. Well, there we go. That's really what I'm going to say about the negotiations, the diplomacy, and about the war. It is the war that matters more. If Pokrovsk falls over the next couple of days or week or so before the summit in Budapest, then that will have an effect on what happens at the summit. It will harden further, in my opinion, the feeling within the Trump team that this is a debacle that they must distance themselves from, and it is more likely to commit them to that course. And perhaps, just to finish, one further small reason for optimism about the meeting in Budapest is that at some point over the next couple of days, Rubio and Lavrov are going to speak. Then apparently they're going to meet. There's going to be many more attempts, a much more structured approach to this summit meeting than to the Alaska summit meeting. And that may mean that we finally do see some progress in sorting out the many problems in the relationships between the Americans and the Russians at this time. A full rapprochement, a detente, almost certainly out of reach, but a certain relaxation of tensions, talks about strategic weapons, the re-establishment of links, air links, all of that ought to be possible, and it would improve the atmosphere, and it would be a worthwhile thing to agree in Budapest, and it can be done. Now, I will finish this program by adding to some further information I've had from the Russian side. Firstly, I've been provided with some information about meetings that Putin has had with senior officials in the Russian parliament, the Duma. And all of this relates to the American plan, or at least the European proposal, that the Americans deploy Tomahawk missiles in Ukraine. I understand that the Russians had every intention of making a very strong reaction had such a deployment taken place. That Putin was discussing what this reaction would be with key committees of the Duma and their chairs and vice chairs suggests that he was preparing the ground for authorization, parliamentary authorization, for some very strong measures. So those who continue to say that this was all smoke and mirrors and just bluff, well, the Russians took it seriously, and I feel that so should we. The other thing that I've heard from the Russians, from the Russian side, again, I can't confirm this, is that the Russians, apparently, the Duma, has had a briefing about the true situation with the Russian frozen assets that the Europeans are going to be playing games with before very long. And apparently the Duma has been told by the Russian government that the Russians believe that $100 billion of those frozen assets has already gone. That the Europeans have been playing, it's been described to me, shell games with these assets. Pretty much what my colleague and friend Alex Cristoforo has been saying all along, and that in reality, $100 billion of this money has already gone. I think probably that is true. It seems to be what the Russians themselves believe. It would explain the urgency to deal with the remaining assets now and to set up this whole narrative about Russia eventually paying a reparations loan. Of course, if there's ever a proper, serious accounting done as to what has happened to this money, well, there might be all sorts of problems. I can even imagine legal action, and legal action against some of the individuals involved, including, I am sorry to say, some of the officers at Euroclear. Just saying. But anyway, that is what I've heard, and I suspect it is true, and if so, it doesn't surprise me. Now, there we are. We are now going to be looking at several weeks in the run-up to the summit in Budapest. Rubio and Lavrov, as I said, first have to speak, and then they have to meet. I suspect the telephone conversation will happen very soon. It might already have happened, by the way. We will soon find out. There will be a meeting. There will be advanced parties. There will be attempts to sort out and agree the agenda and to identify the various items. And hopefully this time, unlike what happened in Alaska, we might even get a communique of some kind, which will take this whole process a whole big step further. And Orban, who is very familiar with all of this, will no doubt be there to provide guidance and assistance. So we'll see. But for the moment, and in the meantime, it is the war, the progress in the war, that truly matters. If it is indeed the case that Pokrovsk is perhaps days from falling, if the Russians are indeed across the Dnieper in Kherson City, as even some Ukrainians are now admitting, then we're likely to get even more dramatic news within the next few days, and it will that which will shape the entire narrative and discussion and everything else about this war. Well, this is where I finish my program today. Remind you again, if please, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. And also, if you want to check out our programs, you can find them on various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X, and you can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop, links under this video. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.